can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find.
Good evening and welcome to CKUT 90.3 FM and to the December edition of Older Women Live, feminist radio on the air once a month, produced by a small group of old women. Now, tomorrow, the 10th of December, Thursday, is Human Rights Day, the anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly adopting the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. The theme this year is related to COVID-19 and asks that we build back better. We all want peace, justice, democracy, and human rights, but instead, sadly, the opposite is true. Tonight, we're looking at the case of Guatemala and its struggle against Canadian mining companies. Brisna Kajet-Rowe, one of our radio collective members, recently interviewed Jackie McVicker, Canadian researcher, writer, activist, and human rights observer who's lived in Guatemala for the last 15 years.
Hello, everyone. Today we will talk about the activities of some Canadian companies in Guatemala in the context of human rights. On the one hand, Canada's most important economic activity is the extraction of non-renewable resources with investments in mining in Canada, Latin America, Africa, and Oceania. So pretty much all around the world. On the other hand, Guatemala is a country rich in mineral reserves containing gold, silver, nickel, petroleum, uranium, etc. Guatemala has one of the largest deposits of silver, and the Guatemalan government gives licenses to Canadian companies to extract the resources found on indigenous people's land without prior consultation or their consent. Moreover, in Guatemala, the violation of human rights is on the rise. And another factor to consider is that the large-scale businesses in Guatemala usually operate under corruption and impunity. And last but not least, people in power in Guatemala are related and belong to the same group of people that violated human rights during the internal armed conflict in Guatemala between 1960 and 1996. So, excuse me, why does Canada invest in mining in Guatemala, knowing all of these factors that we mentioned and knowing who they are doing business with? It seems to me that they believe that there is almost no way they could be held accountable, legally accountable here in Canada or in Guatemala. In spite of all these situations, people in Guatemala that are affected by Canadian mining companies, they organize themselves and fight against these injustices. Just recently, Doña Elena Choc from Lote Ocho community died of cancer after dedicating so many years to the struggle against Hudbay and CGN, a Canadian mining company that extracts nickel in the area. But Doña Elena is not the only person lost in the struggle, and she is not the only victim. We have victims of sexual violence and victims of other forms of violence. Therefore, today's show is dedicated to give a tribute to Doña Elena Choc's struggle and the struggle of so many victims of Canadian mining company in Guatemala. To enlighten us in the struggle these people take, we have with us Jackie Su, a consultant that accompanies Canadian mining cases in Guatemala. Hi, Jackie. Welcome to Older Women Live show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Jackie and I live in Guatemala. I'm a human rights activist and writer. I've been living here for the past 15 years, which corresponds really closely to the time actually when Guatemala was emerging from the conflict that was a genocide against many Maya populations in the country. And it was a time of renewed investment in the country. And a lot of that investment was focused on the extractive sector, which hadn't been exploited to the degree it is, for example, now. So it hadn't been exploited during the conflict period. And many interests were interested in coming here and getting its hands on what was below the soil. So I've worked in a number of organizations over the years, but primarily my work has been on documenting and human rights violations around extractive projects in Guatemala, and then using that work to advocate for both to support communities in Guatemala that are advocating for their rights to be respected, and then in Canada for the Canadian extractive sector to become more accountable for the serious violations that they're committing in countries like Guatemala, but like you said, also all over the world.
Thank you, Jackie. Could you please give us a little brief overview of Canadian mining activities in Guatemala during the last 15 years?
In Guatemala, the Gold Core project, which a lot of Canadians became aware of because of a long standing relationships that Guatemalans living in Canada, for example, Canadian solidarity organizations, and Canadian NGOs that have worked on corporate accountability saw the Marlin project, which was owned principally by Goldcorp during the period of extraction, as a mine that was committing very serious human rights violations, especially in terms of access to water for Indigenous Maya Mam and Maya Sipekapense communities in the northern part of the country. And so in the last 15 years, there's been a series of struggles, and definitely that mine, that was the first time that, for example, there was mass mobilizations by Indigenous nations that were coming to the capital, that were denouncing the Canadian government, for example, protests outside of the embassy. It was a period of time when people were launching, not knowing exactly where to go, but trying to find recourse wherever they could. So filing legal complaints, both nationally and internationally. There was obviously deep concerns about water contamination. And so I think a lot of what was happening at the beginning was an attempt to make the state be responsible. And over time, I think it's also led in the past 15 years to more community monitoring, knowing that the state isn't going to take responsibility, especially for the communities that are most negatively impacted by mining companies. And so I think the really interesting thing that's happened in the past 15 years is around Indigenous sovereignty of territory and resources, and the right of communities to say no to mining projects in their territory. And really, I mean, I think the pattern that we saw, for example, around the Goldcorp mine, the Marlin mine in San Marcos, was kind of the classic model that we see repeated all over the country of, you know, first, it's a kind of what they call a junior mining company coming in and doing the exploration, generally that's accompanied with like a series of lies that that company tells the local community, saying that they're there because they're gonna they're working on a local development project, that they don't exactly come out and say it's gonna be a mine. In the case of San Marcos, they told people they were gonna start up they were going to be sowing flowers and it was going to be a large greenhouse project, and that's why they were taking soil samples. So this kind of initial phase of lies, and then these promises that somehow this is going to not negatively impact anybody, and on top of that it's going to promise jobs. And so essentially what happened in that case is that a lot of people sold their land, which was later contested because it's mostly collective ownership of the territory. And so, but the company was coming in and buying pieces of land from individual owners. And then that, you know, and then when people refused to sell their land, or over time as people started finding out what the actual purpose was, and we're saying, no, we don't want this here, that followed a huge campaign to criminalize people. So there were, this was kind of the first time around an extractive project, for example, a mining project where seven men were maliciously charged by the public prosecutor. And so that was kind of this phenomena of criminalization that we began to see. And that was really early on in the project in 2007, I'm sorry. And really the attempt to silence people that were protesting. So this criminalization came out of a protest that was happening at the mine entrance. And so there's kind of this way to manipulate the law. Similarly, in Canada, the same kind of tactics that are used against Indigenous communities trying to protect their territories, where people are charged with trespassing, people are charged with damages to private property. And so this was used against a group of prominent leaders in the community in an attempt to kind of silence people and stop the resistance movement. And then following that criminalization process, where most of the men, all the charges after a year were dropped, but they, you know, were subject to this legal process that was really onerous because they had to pay for lawyers, they had to you know, take transportation to the city, which is a few hours away. So all these costs that were also involved that really kind of distract people from their key focus, which is protecting their territory, and then forcing people to become focused on trying to get out of charges for protecting the territory. And then the following year, there was a really important case of criminalization against eight women. And it started with a woman, Crisanta Perez, who the company had asked if they could put electricity lines through her property. And originally she had said yes. And when they started to put them up, they were these huge towers that were just basically absorbed all of her land. So all the land that she was using for sowing her crops and for her family and for selling locally in markets, she no longer had that land. And so she started to protest that, and other women joined in with her. And they were also criminalized, not only criminalized, but really this criminalization almost always is accompanied by these terrible campaigns of defamation or hate campaigns, where there's rumors spread about people in the community. The company pays, you know, kind of its people to start rumors, to threaten people. You know, many of the women said at that time that they were afraid to go to the market. Like, they didn't even want to go buy food for their family because they were afraid of what could happen, of the insults that they would get. At one point, Crescenta was arbitrarily detained, illegally detained by the police and taken. And it was only because people followed that police truck and documented everything that she was able to be released. So it, one thing is this kind of criminalization campaign, and then on top of that is all of these kind of what people talk about, the breakdown of the social fabric of a community, which happens when there's these divisions that are mostly not widespread, and it's not like half the community is in favor and half the community is not. It's like a few provocateurs are often paid to create divisions, but they have terrible effects on everyone, and especially women who, for example, in San Marcos, where a lot of men leave for work and they go down to the coast, for example, to pick coffee. And so a lot of women are the head of their household. And so these campaigns, threats of violence, threats of sexual violence, obviously that makes it very difficult for someone to say, I'm going to continue to be part of a movement to protect my territory because I'm afraid what could happen to me or what could happen to my kids. And people like Crisanta, who essentially had to leave her home in exile for many months on end and leave her, I think she had 8 or 9 kids, and she had to leave them on lots of occasions because she was afraid of what might happen to her. I talk a lot about Marlon because I think it was this example that later was used in other parts of the country. So this was like late 2000s. And around this same time, the Canadian government played an extremely important role in promoting this mine. This was a wholly owned Canadian operation. Every ambassador during that period of time, I would say over the course of 5 or 6, 7 years, would make public statements alongside the company. They would support these initiatives of like so-called development. For example, in San Miguel Ixtahuacán, which is the municipality that was the heart of where the Marlon Project was working, you know, they invested, the company apparently gave all this money to create a hospital. They had a huge grand opening, you know, and a few years later I was there and they couldn't even, I mean, the hospital was not working because they couldn't even pay the electricity bills at the hospital. So there's kind of this so-called state-of-the-art hospital, but no doctors are in it. They can't turn on the lights because they can't afford to. I think there was a lot of pushback by also civil society and indigenous community saying it's not the responsive. Companies aren't responsible for our development. Like the state has a responsibility to ensure that we have healthcare. This shouldn't be based on whether or not we agree to have a mine in our territories. So I think there were a lot of lessons around that in San Miguel Ixtahuacán. The Marlon mine operated very, very profitably for many years. It's closed now. Goldcorp eventually sold the mine, which is often what happens when mining companies are done the initial exploitation phase. They sell off to other companies that, for example, then start selling kind of like the assets on the ground. Like they start, you know, tearing up the processing plant and they sell off the machinery, or they come and do, like there's different companies that do different things. And so Goldcorp, I mean, what they were key on doing was just exploiting as much as possible with the lowest costs and then leaving. So over the course of that time, I think it's really important to say that one of the things that the communities did do was apply for protection from the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, which is kind of a body of the OAS that was created kind of as a last resort. These precautionary measures are kind of a last resort for people whose lives are at risk. And so the communities alleged that their lives were at risk because their entire watershed was at risk. So there were cases, I think around that mine, there were 17 different springs that dried up. People were, you know, saying we don't have water, we can't, and the water we do have is contaminated. The Inter-American Commission granted, initially they said the mining operations should stop, which was a huge moment, and that's actually never happened in the history of the Inter-American Commission that they've ordered any like a mining company to actually stop, the state to enforce the company to stop operations. And so they had originally said that the company should stop operations while they could investigate and find out what was really happening. But due to a lot of pressure, that was changed. The president of the time, who was Alvaro Colon, initially said he would stop operations, but he didn't. And later the commission changed the measures and said, okay, if you're not going to stop the operations, what you have to do is ensure that all these communities whose water is being impacted have access to safe and potable water. And so it was the responsibility of the state to ensure that people could have access to water. But what ended up happening is it became a political tool as well to benefit the mine. So people who were against the mine didn't end up getting access to that water, or they had to pay for water. I mean, this wasn't a project that, you know, people were saying, okay, everybody has to pitch in, you know, $100 to get this running water to your house. I mean, this was an order by the commission to the state, and the state had the responsibility to comply with that, and they didn't. And so this has obviously been kind of I think people started looking at Marlin. There was also, if some people listening might remember, there was obviously as well, because of all the explosions that they were doing with the dynamite to build the mine, you know, people's homes were cracking. And in some cases, the entire homes just fell apart because of the explosions that were occurring, which is, you know, the mining company at the time said, no, these are because there's, you know, there's faults in the land, and this is a natural reoccurrence. But, you know, since they've stopped working, no one is complaining about their houses being, you know, fissures and cracks in their house. So, and so a lot of people, this is the reality. And I think it's important because I think it, for example, in other cases, when mining started ramping up in other parts of the country, everybody looked to Merlin and said, we do not want what happened at that mine to happen in our territory. And so there was a big push by the Canadian government at one point early on as well to make a law that would limit the use of Indigenous people's rights to free, prior, and informed consent. So there was a big push to create a law, for example, that would dominate how community-based consultations should take place. So one of the things that happened at around the Marlin mine and in Sipacapa, there was a campaign, Sipacapa no se vende, and that was this whole idea that the community does not want this project, and we're going to come together and we're going to talk about it as an Indigenous community, and then we're going to decide whether or not we want this project. And in Sipacapa, they had a municipal referendum and they voted no. That, I think, also set the course for much of how the resistance to large-scale extractive projects in Guatemala, especially mining, have played out. Because I think they said, you can't tell us, as an Indigenous nation, you can't tell us how to consult our people. We know how to consult our people. We always, our history has been based on consultation with our people. And so you're not going to tell us how to do that. And I think that also set the course for what we see now in other territories like Xinka territory and Kekchikel territory, around kind of this idea of you can force a way for there to be consultation. You know, what the Canadian government was really pushing was like, let's dialogue, let's find out how to get, it was never about Indigenous communities upholding the right to say no. It was like, how, what can we do so that you say yes? And so I think that was really, there was a huge pushback on that. Kind of some of, at least, the overt campaigning that the Canadian embassy was doing shifted a bit. It didn't go away, but I think their strategy shifted from doing these big public appearances to support mining companies to likely more backroom kind of negotiations that were happening in order for Canadian mining companies to be able to continue their work in Guatemala. So those are, I think, the main kind of things that have happened in the last 15 years are around Indigenous communities saying they will hold consultation and they have the right to veto and they can decide exactly what happens in their territory. It's been really important, and it's been upheld by the Constitutional Court in three different cases. That right has been upheld. And in your introduction, you talked a bit about investors and why would investors, and really there is no negative consequence. I mean, for them, they come to Guatemala, they exploit, they destroy communities, they make a huge amount of profit, and then they leave. And so, but what the big thing is now is that we're seeing is that when Indigenous communities take legal recourses, but also continue to mobilize at a really grassroots level in terms of like camps and roadblocks. Those have huge impacts that have led to projects being stopped. Those are really, really important, kind of the grassroots mobilizing. That's what investors should know about, that the fact that projects aren't going to happen here so long as communities are informed and as long as they can mobilize to stop those projects from happening.
Thank you, Jackie. So I think you mentioned very important things in terms of the criminalization and also that is used to demobilize people in the communities where these resources are found, and also how they fight, and also the fact that at least they have a voice to stop these projects into coming to their communities.
Our first song tonight is Sarah Kuruchi.
Baulef chukakar, ukumas mshachoria rikak. En los suelos y los cielos, ukumas danza agua y fuego, danza el árbol con el viento. Espiral de tiempo. De la raíz de la tierra crecen los versos que entintan esperanza. La abuela Shmukanete teje melodías al alma sin color ni distinción. Los pueblos bailan y cantan. Somos viento, somos sol y sueños multicolores. Somos este norte, sur y oeste. Somos historia, lienzo y canción. Escribimos el tiempo junto a voces y miradas. Nuestros sueños navegan bajo el sol. Somos este norte, sur y oeste. Somos viento, somos sol, tejidos multicolor. Somos este norte, sur y oeste. Escribimos en el tiempo junto a voces y miradas. Nuestros sueños navegan bajo el sol y la luna misma. Dejamos puentes sin distancia ni fronteras. Somos viento, somos sol. Somos este norte, sur y oeste. Somos vida, somos son, la historia y canción. Somos las venas de la tierra, la humanidad sin
Could you tell us a little bit about the Doña Elena Choc case, I mean the Lote Ocho case, and what happened there? Could you give us a little bit more details about that case?
Sure, so Doña Elena and 10 other women in 2007, they're in Maya Kekchi territory. So they're around Lake Izawal and the eastern part of the country. And historically, this has been where in the 1960s, a Canadian mining company called Inco, a huge nickel mining company, began operating in the country. And so back in around that time, they started building this processing plant, which is literally on the shores of Lake Izabal. And they started building this project, started saying that they had ownership over a lot of land, which they didn't have ownership of. So this is goes back to one of these like profoundly important questions, especially in Guatemala, where the majority of the population is indigenous, around ancestral land titles. And so there's actually, it's really interesting, some of the law that's happening now around who actually has these land titles. When communities have lived in a territory for generations and they maybe don't have a piece of paper, and they say that they live there, but they've lived there for generations. And what has happened is that a lot of companies, you know, with lawyers and corrupt state functionaries have made kind of false land titles to say that different people. So this didn't happen even in the 60s, it was happening in liberal reform, like at the turn of the last century. But this has led to today a lot of big companies, especially in that part of in eastern Guatemala, that are like now today, like palm oil companies and sugar plantations of these very, very rich families that have land title over territories that were never theirs. And there's a lot of questions of how they even got the land title in the first place. And so this company, Inco, at the time was, you know, doing exactly the same thing. In reality, they didn't really start operations because nickel prices fell, but they maintained their license for 50 years. So they had this 50-year license that allowed them to kind of exert this power over communities who lived kind of always with the threat that something could happen if the mine started operating again. Inco's been tied to serious human rights violations, the murder of academics that were reporting on mines back in the 60s and 70s. There were people, there was a man, you know, there was people shot. There was the minister of the environment back in the day that was, there was political persecution. And so I think that kind of history, they've also been tied to a massacre that happened in Panzos, which was kind of this really emblematic massacre that happened against a Kekchi, several Kekchi communities that were trying to defend their land essentially in their territory back in, and this was in 1978 that massacre happened. There's pictures of like the Inco company trucks taking away the bodies that were killed that day, you know, in the Panzos town square. And so the history of the company, if there are people that live in Canada in these kind of mining towns and they talk of like the company, you know, it's just been always been there historically. It's part of like who the community is. And that is really the case of this, of the communities. There's always kind of been this omnipresent company that has been around. And so not a lot was happening at the mine for many, 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 many years. And in the 2000s, nickel prices started to go up. And nickel's used a lot in to make weapons and also arms. So, you know, when there's more wars, there's an increase in for nickel, amongst other uses, uranium. When nickel prices started to go up, there was a new interest in this mine. And essentially, a company called Sky Resources, which was a company that basically was Inco, but it was another, it was the same board of directors, but they made a new company. It was called Sky Resources. And they applied for a new license to operate. They had to get an environmental license again and to kind of reactivate what was happening. They had the concession itself, but they needed to renew some of the licenses. So this happened in 2006. As soon as the state granted these licenses, a series of illegal and extremely violent land evictions started to happen. And there were three kind of most famous ones happening that were in different communities. And one of those happened in Lote Ocho. And in Lote Ocho, in January of 2007, the community was extremely violently evicted by hundreds of police. And this was actually all documented. People had started hearing rumors that there was going to be an eviction. And so a lot of journalists, actually Canadian journalists and filmmakers that were in the country, went to the area to document. I don't think they had any idea of what they were going to see or witness, which was the burning of homes, of violence, you know, people having their homes literally torn down in front of their eyes, everything they owned being taken from them by the police, and is mostly by the police at that point. So there's a lot of images of some of those evictions. And so in Lote Ocho, what happened, where there weren't journalists documenting, was that security for the company and state security very violently gang raped 11 women, at least 11 women. Many of those women, several of those women were pregnant and lost their babies. Others were physically, like, you know, their bodies were beyond the possibility of recuperation. And Doña Elena was one of those women. And it took a long time for them to come forward to tell their story. And they decided to do that after some other people that were affected by this mine. So a couple of years after after this very violent eviction happened, a man named Adolfo Ich was murdered. He was a teacher, and he was a community organizer. He was in his community, and he was murdered on broad daylight by mine security. And another man that day, who was just basically somebody who was watching a soccer game, and then was shot in the midst of basically the security forces opened fire on a crowd, and he was shot and paralyzed. And his name is Herman Chub. So Herman Chub, who has suffered these, you know, he was like a 23-year-old man at the time, a young father, had his whole life ahead of him. He was shot and paralyzed, and to this day is in a wheelchair. And so he, along with the widow of Adolfo Ich, her name is Angelica. So probably some people listening may have met Angelica Chuk, who has gone to Canada several times, filed a civil case in Canada with the support of Rights Action and lawyers from a law firm called Klippensteins that were determined to kind of bring to light the situation in Canada. So essentially, that case was originally filed in 2010. And the women, by Angelica and Herman, and then a year later, the women who had been gang raped joined that lawsuit. So it's part of kind of the same proceeding. It's a separate case, but it's all part of kind of the same structural violence that the company, in collusion with state security forces, was perpetrating against Indigenous communities in order to advance their project. Between 2007 and 2009, Sky actually sold to another Canadian mining company called Hudbay Resources. And so it's Hudbay Resources that is being sued in Canada in the civil suit. And since then, Hudbay has sold their company to now a Russian Swiss company that is operating. And it's what Hudbay and the legacy of that Canadian Inco, Sky, Hudbay has just gotten worse. I mean, there's been more people killed in the past years. There's more encroachment of Indigenous territory. There's extremely violent actions that have been happening recently because the communities recently won a court injunction in their favor. So in kind of response to that, there's been even more aggressions. There's been a state of siege that was implemented there for the better part, actually, of the past year. There's been limitation on communities being able to even like protest because of these state of prevention or a state of siege that's been implemented at a national level, but for that specific territory. So that's kind of the history and the legacy, I think, of the violence around that mine continues to this day. And Doña Elena and the other women, it wasn't until actually a few weeks ago, they've been accompanied by Guatemalan feminist and women's organizations, and they filed to the public prosecutor their case, asking for there to be an investigation for the gang rape against them. And so this would be to complement a civil case happening in Canada against Hudbay, would be the criminal case to show the responsibility of the company for having inflicted this very serious crimes against them.
Thank you very much. Do you think that there are chances that they will win the case?
In Canada, their case is moving ahead. It's very slow. I mean, I think these kind of colonial courts that have been set up are not the best way to obviously address like the urgency of what communities are living. So there's an order to do something, then there's non-compliance, and then you have to, each side has the possibility to fight that, and just takes so long for there to be recourse for people. Doña Elena, I actually got to meet, I had met her in Guatemala, and then when she was giving her testimony and during a kind of a preliminary hearing in Canada, I was able to be with her in Canada and some of the other women. And their case is moving forward, and they are so, their case is so strong. And I think what has happened also in Canada is that not only are the courts going to hear this case, a really important thing, a recent ruling admits in this kind of preliminary phase has been by the courts to say that the Canadian company Hudbay is responsible for what Guatemalan police did. That's a really important, so they're not even only saying the security for the mining company, but the police who are accompanying the security. So that kind of saying that the courts have said that they're responsible for that. And so that was a huge, the most we can hope for is kind of like going back to this Marlin case, these precedents, hopefully that will show companies that they can't work in collusion with extremely repressive and violent state security forces that are going to violate human rights, rape women, because this is a trend you see around mining companies all around the world, right? And so if Canadian companies can be responsible for rapes that happen around Canadian mine sites in Canada, this case can be really groundbreaking, right? Because this could just say, like, this has to stop. And, you know, one of the major problems is that there's just zero mechanisms in Canada to make Canadian companies responsible for any of these serious things that they're doing. There is just no mechanism. So I think that they have a really good case in Canada. They have an extremely strong case. I think the benefit of taking this case to Canada is one around the corporate accountability side and trying to set this precedent for other companies. And I think in terms of like justice for the women kind of being heard in a court that they feel is more impartial, for example, than what they might have access to in Guatemala, where there is obviously a lot of racism against Indigenous communities. And so kind of being able to testify and tell their truth to a court that is willing to hear them is, like, I think really important for them. And I think the case in Guatemala will definitely have a lot of barriers. And I think it's really symbolic, and it's really important because there have been other cases where serious violations against women, Indigenous women, have happened in Guatemala, thanks to like so much work that the survivors and organizations accompanying them have done. There is a possibility that there could be a criminal responsibility then, and the company could be held responsible, but I think it will also be a very long road for that to happen. But that's her legacy. And I think Elena and all the women who have done this work, and they too, I mean, I talked about Crisanta and San Marcos, but many of the women from Dote Ocho have had to leave their homes. They haven't been criminalized, but there's been definitely campaigns, hate campaigns, defamation campaigns saying, you know, they're going to Canada and they're getting all this money. And and just kind of the way that the company has worked, and also communities where there's is extreme poverty, you know, and so trying to separate communities because, you know, along these lines of who's getting paid and offering jobs to specific people to create divisions. I think it's the reality that a lot of people are living is really, really hard, but I'm hopeful for them.
Thank you very much for all this information, Jackie.
Cámara 1. Cámara 2. Audio. Acción.
How different is Tahoe and Pan American Canadian companies? They extract silver in Guatemala as well. Could you tell us a bit about this case, if it is different from the other ones?
Sure, it's a little bit different because of the Inco mine has been operating on and off since the 1960s. And there's kind of, like I was saying, there's kind of this idea of like the company's just always been present in that territory. And then later around the Marlin mine, because the company came in, essentially was operating before people even knew what was kind of happening. It was really like the response to the Marlin mine was... they couldn't stop it. You know, they couldn't stop it because it was already started and there was no political will to stop it. And what happened at Tahoe, I mean, the company there also tried to do a lot of the same thing. And it's important to say that the person who originally started the Tahoe mine was a person who originally worked for Goldcorp. So this was somebody who even, he learned kind of about how to do business in Guatemala, who was on his side. This is also all related to the, in 2015, just this little thing I want to share is just around, in 2015 in Guatemala, there were these huge protests around corruption, which eventually led to, you know, the president having to step down and the vice president having to step down and, you know, a whole bunch of ministers either fleeing the country or being arrested. And those ministers included the ministers that were responsible for granting mining licenses, right? And so the Minister of Energy and Mines was named, the ministers, you know, of communications, the all the people that are responsible not only for granting mining licenses, but ensuring that all the infrastructure that needs to happen, building roads, telecommunications, everything that needs to happen around a huge project like this, they were involved in that corruption. And so I think it's just really important to kind of, I think, name that. The mining companies know that, they know who they have to kind of cozy up to and who their friends are and where they need to pad pockets and that kind of thing. And what happened around the Tahoe mine was very similar in the beginning in some way. The community started to hear about what was happening. And they started protesting that. And there were a few people, especially early on, that were part of kind of this movement, you know, no to mining. And so when that started to happen, the criminalization of those people started. So the criminalization and defamation campaigns started right away, but there was a possibility. So there was like, at one point, there was like 120 people that were criminalized. Like it was a lot of people at the beginning. And then a really important thing that happened there also in 2013, when a lot of the resistance, it was like very heated, lawyers just trying to do whatever they could to stop the licenses. One, the indigenous Xinka population hasn't been consulted. So they filed an amparo, an injunction against that, that there had been no free prior informed consent. But they also were trying to stop saying that it was illegal, some of like the environmental licenses. And essentially what happened is that in anybody possibly affected by the mine, which was a really important strategy that they used in Tahoe at the beginning, was that if you could show that you would be directly impacted, you could make a statement saying why the license shouldn't be granted. So literally like dozens of people did that. And the responsibility of the state was to respond to each of those concerns. And so this is an area of the country where there's been historically a lot of crop grain, like tomatoes and coffee and peppers, kind of for local markets, like national markets, you know? And so, but this is like an area where farmers have just always had their product. And so people were like, well, yeah, this is going to affect our possibility to irrigate. And because of, you know, our rivers are going to dry up, they're going to be contaminated. And so people were filing all these administrative complaints. And essentially what happened in April 2013 is that the company came in. So that was kind of helping people buy some time because they were able to use that time to kind of say, like, what are we going to do? What's our next step? And the resistance, and I think Canadian and U.S. solidarity groups and NGOs working on extractives also played a really big role in denouncing what was happening there. So just doing a lot of like international comunicados, press releases, just saying like the community is in resistance. They are making known that they do not agree with this project. Kind of documenting that has been really important in that case. In April 2013, essentially what happened is that, you know, the communities, they were doing protests, they were doing marches, they were doing kind of all the things that people do when they feel like they're not being heard and they want their voices to be taken into account. And so in April of 2013, all of these administrative complaints were resolved in one day, which is not how it's supposed to happen. And they were all resolved with the same answer. Once that happened, a couple of days later, essentially, the Canadian ambassador as an honorary witness and other ambassadors saw the company sign its agreement with the Ministry of Energy and Mines. And that led to the license being granted and essentially clearing the way for the project to go ahead. So what happened in response to that is that the community set up basically a 24-hour protest outside of the mine site. And they said, we're not going to let this happen. You know, we've been saying for years, we don't want this project, so we're not going to let it happen. So they started doing that. And a couple of weeks after that, the mining company security opened fire against the protesters. There was nothing to do. They were shot against. They were unarmed people. There was not even that many people. There was maybe just over a dozen people outside of the mine. It was like, I think it was like a Sunday afternoon. Like, no, they were just kind of standing around, but they wanted there to be kind of always presence at this site to make sure that nothing happened. And so essentially the company opened fire and shot these men. A number of people were shot in the back. A young man was shot in the face. Luckily, nobody lost their lives. The company immediately came out and said that they were rubber bullets and that they had been attacked by people with machetes. But a really interesting and important thing was happening because leading up to that, there had, in the months prior to that, there had been a lot of very violent actions, like explosions. A security company had its truck intervened, and then one of the security members were shot, and they tried to blame the community for it. So there was just all these things that the communities always were saying, "This, we did not do that, we did not do that." And essentially what had happened, and at the time there was an attorney general, Claudia Passy Press, who had a different vision for at least some of the things that were related. They had actually started investigating the company for essentially self-sabotaging the project they were basically investigating them for like the murder, all these things that were happening, and they're trying to blame the companies for, which is part of what I was saying earlier. It's part of this attempt to destroy the social fabric and say that these protesters are causing all these problems. They had started to tap the phones of the head of the security company. And so when these men were shot, they were hearing his phone calls after that. They heard him call the local police. And when he told the local police, "This is just what happened. This is what you're going to say happened. You're going to go there and clean up all the bullet shells. You're going to tell people the police statement is going to say that we were attacked, that this was an act of self-defense." So, you know, you see this collusion right away with the local police. He was also heard saying things like, "We're not going to let this happen. What's happening in La Puya," which is another mining project where a peaceful protest has stopped the mine for almost a decade now. He was just heard on tape saying all these things. And eventually he was caught at the airport trying to escape the country. And so this head of security, he was a man from Chile who had been military trained in the U.S., had come to Guatemala to be the head of the security company at the mine, was caught and charged for his role in what had happened. And really, it was thanks to those wiretaps that a lot of this, you know, kind of the criminal structure that operates behind mining companies was exposed, which everybody always says, but it was just like so clear, you know, it was like the evidence was there this time. So, and around that same time, another really important thing that happened is that the state of Guatemala implemented a state of siege there. And that, together with the shooting, so the men were shot, and like 3 days later, the state of Guatemala implemented a state of siege in, I think, 4 municipalities. And that basically just served to really try to stop the resistance, you know, because people were terrified. Like people on one hand were being shot. And then as soon as the state of siege happened, all these people had, you know, their homes were like just arbitrarily, like the police would show up your house and go in because they didn't need a warrant to investigate. People were criminalized. Other people left like in fear. People left the country. People left the area. It had a huge impact. After that, a series of really important things it took a little while. It was just, there was so much violence also happening there. But essentially, the legal actions that they had been taking started to pay off. And so some of the court decisions started coming back saying, yes, this community was not consulted. That was like a huge win. The communities had set up a permanent camp outside of the court in Guatemala for months. And at the same time, they had a permanent camp stopping all vehicles related to the mining project from entering their territory. And they've maintained that. There's still this camp. It's 24 hours a day. People take turns. It's been going on for, I think, if I'm not wrong, 3 years that this permanent camp has been happening. And really that has stopped this company from being able to go ahead. This is an important case. Some of the men who were shot also filed a civil complaint in Canada against the company, Tahoe, in Vancouver. They eventually came to like an amicable resolution between them, but the community saw this as a win because the company had to admit that they were responsible for what had happened there. Tahoe later sold to Pan Am, and sadly, instead of kind of trying to change course or try and do mining in a different way, they've kind of ramped up again these campaigns to divide the community. And the court a couple of years ago, the highest court, the Constitutional Court, said that the community had to be consulted before the mine project could go ahead. And so that's really given fuel for the grassroots mobilizing because the courts are on their side, but the state and the company have really tried to manipulate that ruling to benefit them. So there's just a constant kind of push and work being done at a local level to say we're not going to participate in a consultation unless it's how we define it to be as the Indigenous community affected by the project. So that's basically what's happened. In lots of ways, I think it's a big, they've achieved so much and they've stopped this mine from happening, but it's only thanks to like constant work. You know, a young woman, Topacio Reynoso, was murdered.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African Current Affairs brought to you on CQT 90.3 FM. And tonight I'm sitting here with Doug, and we're really devoting most of the show to a book that is not strictly speaking about Africa at all. It's called Fighting a Hand to Hold, Confronting Medical Colonialism Against Indigenous Children in Canada. It is written by Samir Shaheen Hussein, who is an emergency pediatrician here in Montreal at the Montreal Children's Hospital. So kind of something that's off the beaten track for us here on Amandla, but Doug and I had the most amazing discussion with Samir yesterday about his book, and that's what we'll be presenting to you tonight. But it begs the question, why are we doing this?
Well, and for me, it was so striking to hear a medical professional on a national CBC radio use the term medical colonialism. We at Amandla have dedicated our show in large part to discussing the continuing colonial project in Africa and what it takes and the trauma that it's left and the exploitation that it still implies and what goes on. And to here in Canada, we tend to think of ourselves as benign and humanitarian, and it's not